Hello, Kevin Savitz.
Hello, Carrington Vanston. How are you?
I'm excellent. I was recently watching you.
What?
You couldn't see me.
Oh, creepy.
I was looking at you from the internet.
Wow, I was on the internet.
You are likely to be eaten.
You are likely to be eaten by a group. If this predicament seemed particularly cruel, consider whose fault it could be. Now the torture of a match in your inventory. You are likely to be eaten by a group. If this predicament seemed particularly cruel, consider whose fault it could be. Now the torture of a match in your inventory.
Creepy thing called the internet, where you are having a discussion with an imp, which all sounds very high fantasy, but it's actually somebody who used to create Infocom Adventures, one of the big ones.
Yes, indeed. So yeah, this crazy thing happened. I got to go down to San Francisco for the day. I went to the GitHub headquarters and I interviewed Steve Moretzky of Infocom fame, live on stage in front of a crowd. And
everything about this is impressive to me. Like, I was just hanging out at the GitHub headquarters. It's like a big part. Is that like in a Skull Mountain thing? It's like that just sounds really cool.
Kind of.
And interviewing Steve Moretzky, and then just like all of this is amazing. Like, I just, it's completely thrilling. I enjoyed the interview. I enjoyed everything about this. But the fact that this happened is amazing.
Yes, it is. And I kind of talk about how this happened at the beginning of the interview to give some context. Basically, I did it to give context to the young people who might have been watching who didn't know what an Infocom was. But our buddy Jason Scott put all of the Infocom Z Machine source code up on GitHub. And that amazed a lot of people, and it amazed the people at GitHub, and they were just like, let's do an event around this. And they asked Jason to come out and talk about it and interview Moretzky, and Jason wasn't available due to previous commitments, but Jason suggested me, and yay, I'm second choice. So
that's Jason Light.
Yes, exactly. Yeah, so it was, I mean, it was wild, Carrington. They flew me down, and I took a lift, you know, straight to the venue at GitHub headquarters, which is pretty much a cavern in under the sea or something. It was pretty amazing.
Well, one would assume it would be some sort of lair. Now, did they did you give them a rider? Did they have to give you like M&Ms, but with all the you know the yellow ones picked out or something?
Yeah, absolutely. Yes.
Excellent. Yeah. Excellent. That's how you roll.
I only wanted the yellow ones, but
oh, I see.
So I get down there and I got a tour of the headquarters, and they gave me some swag, and I got a sweatshirt and stuff, and Moretzky was there, and I kind of got to talk to him before, and we made small talk, and then we did the interview, and then afterwards there's a bar in GitHub headquarters, there's a full, very well stocked hipster bar there.
Of course there is.
Yeah. They had fancy drinks and with available for everyone who was there.
Do you order or do you do a pull request?
Right. They push. Yeah. I don't know. Get push the drinks to you.
I'm going to fork your whiskey because I think this one's better.
When we did the talk, there were maybe, 20 or 25 people in the audience, a combination of just text adventure nerds who had came out, and then GitHub employees and things like that. And then I guess another, 100 people watched on the Twitter feed.
Because it was a streamed.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And, so we did the talk, and then afterwards they opened the bar and, I hung out for an hour and a half and talked to, text adventure nerds and Moretzky was there and kind of the most best conversation happened like after the conversation. We were just like, you know, standing around having drinks and
sure.
and people asking him questions, but none of that was recorded. You can't.
Yeah, it's
that.
Too bad that didn't get saved as well. But sometimes that's why it's so good. Is it's just a private conversation
right.
is what it is. But he seems like a good guy. Like the impression I got from the interview, like he was just very casual and nice answers that didn't seem pandering. Like sometimes. Like we'll have it so people can listen to it. But I enjoyed when people were asking like what does he think about the source code being released and people still being interested in creating games this way. So well, that really surprises me. Like, yeah. It's hard to see that that's the best way to do this nowadays.
Right.
And just stuff like that. Like I just like that he doesn't seem as wrapped up in the nostalgia of it as say I am. And so it's an interesting thing, even though he's one of the, you know, the big names.
Yeah.
And you know, did stuff. Oh, I guess we haven't mentioned it, but like he did Planetfall and mm-hmm. Hitchhikers and Leather Goddesses and Stationfall and like, you know,
and Sorcerer and A Mind mm-hmm. Forever Voyaging was his big epic work, you know, that and also he did Zork Zero. So he did seven games for Infocom. Yeah.
Pretty cool.
Yeah, and I think some of the best games. We haven't played some of these yet, but
we haven't played them all, but some of the best ones we've done so far mm-hmm. are among that list. So
yes.
I'm like, oh my goodness. Okay, there's already things he's done that I've loved. So that's awesome.
Yeah.
One thing I learned from the interview is I have been pronouncing Dave Liebling's, well, sorry, Liebling's name wrong.
Mm.
At least according to the way Steve says it. So I've been saying Liebling, but it looks like it's Liebling.
Liebling.
Whoops. So go back and edit all the previous
sure.
episodes.
We'll get right on that. Yeah.
Yeah. Just beep. Beep over all of it.
So, yeah, what we have here is the 1 hour interview that I did. The video of it is also up on YouTube. There's a link to that in the show notes. But most of it, I think, makes sense with just hearing the audio. And it was a great time and an amazing experience. And to think I wouldn't have gotten to do it if it weren't for Eaten by a Grue.
And Jason not being available.
And Jason having to go to the Tribeca Film Festival.
All the
Festival.
Best things in our lives come when Jason is not available.
It's true. Real.
So one of us can step in. The lesser mortals can handle things.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, very cool. So here is the audio, which is really good.
Welcome to Game On. What was it like to make games during the 80s? I am Kevin Savitz. This is Steve Moretzky.
Hello.
Part one, why am I here? I am co-host of Eaten by a Grue. It is a podcast where my buddy and I are playing all of the Infocom games one by one. We're reaching the home stretch, and I have also interviewed more than 300 people who did things with microcomputers on Antic, the Atari 8-bit podcast. Part two, why are you here? You are here because you are watching this because the Infocom source code was released recently, just a few days ago, on GitHub. A quick background, Infocom was a company that made games. They made text adventure games in the 1980s, and they were, for a while, very bestsellers. Many of their games, here's a soft sell bestseller list from, I can't read it now, from December 1983, and Infocom had many, many games on the chart. Now, these were all text adventure games, no graphics, except for the ones that were in your mind. We are here because of Jason Scott. Jason is my friend and colleague. He is free-range archivist at the Internet Archive. He archives millions of things. People send him things. He puts them on the Internet Archive where you can download them. Last week he uploaded 400 manuals for tape recorders, reel-to-reel, and miscellaneous audio equipment. That's there. There's 1,000 manuals for power generators for recreational vehicles. That went up a few days ago. I don't know anything about those things, but I do know about Infocom. And because an anonymous someone sent Jason all of the Infocom source code, which he uploaded to GitHub, where you can download it and play with it and learn from it. So, what was Infocom? Text adventures and interactive fiction. Their first game and their bestseller throughout their history was Zork 1. This is what an Infocom game looked like. it was all text. Now, Infocom was not the first company to do text adventure games, but they did a couple things way better than the others. You didn't have to type something like kill troll. You could type kill the troll with the nasty knife, then go east, and it would understand what you wanted. And that was a pretty big innovation. They also, another big innovation that Infocom did was the games came in great packages, not just like a floppy disk in a plastic baggie, but they were feelies. There were background information and sometimes things you could touch and little trinkets that added to the value and the gameplay. So this is Zork on an Apple II, and here's Zork on my favorite computer, the Atari 800. And the neat thing is, the implementers like Steve could write code that could easily be work on many, many different computers, everything from the PDP-10 to the TRS-80 to the IBM PC to the Apple II, and basically the same code, it would run in a virtual machine that would run on all of these different computers. Steve used a Zork implementation language, ZIL, which was based on another old programming language called MIT Design Language, which itself was based on Lisp. So it was a generic language that ran in a VM. Here's Steve back in the day.
And my brother Mark.
And Mark. Here's another one of Steve. So Steve, enough talking. Enough of me talking. Why were the Infocom programmers called implementers and not programmers or coders or developers or something like that?
Well, the term predates my arrival at Infocom. I think the term dates back to the Lab for Computer Science at MIT, which is where the founders of Infocom came from. And, it refers to the fact that coders were implementing a program, implementing, a software plan. And I think, it just seemed like a cool word. It sounded much more sort of mysterious and powerful than, say, author or, writer or coder.
It really was a combination, it seems like, of coding and writing, because you're actually writing the text in the game as well as the...
It was an interesting, not just combination, but, sort of intertwining. There was really no time when you were working on a game when you weren't, both coding and writing, because the text output and the code were just so intertwined in what you were writing.
Here are the games that Steve wrote or co-wrote. I believe in order, Planetfall, Sorcerer, Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy with Douglas Adams, A Mind Forever Voyaging, Leather Goddesses of Phobos, Stationfall, and Zork Zero had graphics and also didn't fit on the other page. There's you and Douglas Adams. So,
and this is just a stage PR photo in front of the Mac. We didn't really use the Mac for development at all. If you can see kind of behind me there's a VT100, which would be connected to our DEC20. That's what we did all the coding on.
So let's talk about that process. You were on the DEC20, I'm on the VT100 terminal coding. How did that process work when you were creating a game?
In the early days, the DEC20 was all time shared, so everyone is connected to this one mainframe via all of our VT100 terminals. And you would sort of, in a solo state, work on your code until you're ready to compile it, and then you would start compiling. And for a while, if you were the only one who was compiling at any given time, it would compile super quickly. But if several people were compiling programs at the same time, things slowed down far more. It wasn't like three times as slow. If three people were compiling, it would be, 50 times as slow. So eventually someone wrote a queuing program, and then you would just get into, kind of a queuing order and would compile when it was your turn, and that would speed things up for everyone. Really that was the only time when really the power of the mainframe was needed. Obviously the rest of the time writing code, it was really just essentially word processing.
I talked about ZIL, the Lisp variant. It seems like this was your first programming job, right?
I had done some programming as a student,
okay.
But yeah, this was certainly the first time anyone paid me to program.
So this language seems like a rather intense start to programming.
Not really. I mean, I had, you know, the courses that I'd already taken in programming were in Fortran and in PL1, and, you know, I would say ZIL was sort of closer to kind of being something readable by a normal person, a non-programmer. I mean, that was one of the things that was really kind of special about the Infocom development system, was that it really allowed people who weren't hardcore programmers to write something as complex as a text adventure game.
If I showed you some ZIL code, could you tell us what's going on?
If you showed me some ZIL code, I think I would be able to identify it as ZIL code. Yes, that is ZIL code.
Yeah, excellent. Good.
Well, I can't.
Yeah, maybe it's easier. I don't know if this is going to work at all. But so this is in Hitchhiker's Guide after
right. You
have solved the famously difficult Babelfish puzzle and you're taken into the captain's
right. Quarters.
He's going to read you some poetry. And this is just setting up the room, I think, just kind of setting.
Sure. So that piece on top is just the room definition itself. So at this point, you're in a room called the captain's quarters, which is why I named the room captain's quarters. That was sort of my coding technique, is always to have long but very easy to read names. And then in a room, there might be objects, some objects that you could take, other objects that you could just refer to, you know, but would be fixed parts of the room. So, for example, you have the poetry appreciation chair that you're locked into or strapped into, whatever. And then the other things on this particular page are just the routines associated with those objects. So the captain's quarters has a routine, and all it does is, if you're in the captain's quarters and you say look, it just, you know, tells the game what to tell the player if they say look in the captain's quarters. The routine for the poetry appreciation chair handles a number of verbs. The first one is basically if you try to get out of the chair, basically it seems like it's cueing some kind of an interrupt routine called I reply. I have no idea what I reply does. But, you know, then after doing that, it says you're strapped in, remember. And then after that, you're, okay. So anyway, that's yeah. The routine for the chair, and then another object in the room is the captain himself, and he has a routine as well. So that was basically, you know, how the language was structured. Rooms, objects, and then routines associated with them. And then because essentially every input that the player put in had to get some output from the game, then there would be sort of chances for all these things to handle it. The room would get a chance to handle it, the object, the direct object, if there was an indirect object in the sentence, that would get a chance to handle the input. And then eventually, if nothing handled the input, then every verb had its own default. So, you know, open might say something like, you can't open that, or, you know, look, you know, or examine, you know, might say you see nothing special about that. So that was basically all the cases where you tried something that the game had no interesting response for.
And you can override those defaults if you needed to.
And in fact, that was really most of the testing process, was as a game writer, I would write kind of all the, I would write responses for all the things that I thought players were likely to try, but I didn't come close to thinking of all the reasonable ones. And then as the QA group would begin testing the game, they'd say, hey, I tried this, I think that's a reasonable thing. And then I would have to decide, do I agree, you know, that was a reasonable thing to try? Does it deserve its own essentially unique or special response? And of course, in those days, games were limited to a floppy disk, which typically, you know, like, my first game, Planetfall, it had to be smaller than about 108 kilobytes in order to fit on whatever the most limiting machine of that time was. It might have been probably a TRS-80 Model 3 or something like that. So we had, you know, sort of very, very strict size limits, and, you know, we simply couldn't handle every response that we would have liked to handle. So there was a lot of, well, you know, I would like to handle this, but really, how important is that?
So in Zil version 3, that I believe you're working under most of the time, you were limited to 255 objects, which had to include everything that could be mentioned.
That would include the objects as well as the rooms.
And then
for my game Mind Forever Voyaging, we rolled out a new system that we called Interactive Fiction Plus, and that, you know, I mean, it did have some limit, but it was ridiculously high. It was maybe 256 squared or something like that.
Yeah.
And then for the first time, you know, you didn't have to worry, oh, you know, do I really want to use up an object on this?
So at the beginning, when you're working on Planet Fallen Hitchhikers, was it really a choice of, like, I mean, it seems like a lot of choices would have to be made. Are we going to put in this object? If I mention it, then it takes up an object.
Yes. Well, as I said, every room was considered an object and went toward that 255 limit. So a typical geography might have, you know, somewhere between maybe 60 and 100 rooms. And so right there, you know, you're down to under 200 objects that you can refer to. And so room descriptions themselves, you know, would refer to things like, you know, just descriptive things like you're in a cave with dripping stalagmites or something. And they weren't important to the gameplay of the game. They were just there to kind of set the mood. But players might think they were important, would try to refer to them. Like, oh, if I could get myself one of those stalagmites, I could use it as a weapon or something like that, and would try to break off a stalagmite, and the game would say, I don't know the word stalagmite, and then you'd have to say, okay, do I want to have the game understand it, or do I want to remove it from the description and make the room kind of less colorful, or am I okay with the game saying, I don't know the word stalagmite?
You took copious notes and then saved them, which is amazing. This is the part of the log of the every time you compiled Planetfall, which at this point was called Soul Survivor, and you wrote down the number of objects. You started hitting the limit real fast. I mean, these are all 251, and by page 2, it's just pegged at 254, 255 the whole time.
Sure, and you know, at that 255 point, then it's simply a decision every time I want to add an object, okay, what do I have to get rid of? Or what's the object that I'm most willing to get rid of? Is this new object more important than that?
Is there a time when you programmed a puzzle or a room or something and then it just didn't work? It came back from testers. It wasn't fun, or it was too hard, or something, and you just had to throw away work.
Well, certainly the too hard feedback was most prevalent from the Babelfish puzzle in Hitchhiker's Guide, but Douglas wanted it to be hard, and the testers were kind of up in arms about it. They were really pushing back, you know, and saying, no, we have to make it easier, we have to make it more fair. And in fact, when he came over to Cambridge for his last week of working on the Hitchhiker's game, he was just leaving for the airport, and I was essentially saying goodbye to him and being called into a meeting with the entire QA group, you know, and I said, you know, they're going to try to get me to make the Babelfish puzzle easier. What do you think I should tell them? You know, and he thought for a moment, and he said, I think you should tell them to stuff it. Except he put it a little more strongly than that. And so the Babelfish puzzle stayed as it was, and of course it was, you know, so damn hard that Infocom actually sold T-shirts saying, I got the Babelfish.
Nice. So you told them to stuff it, and it stayed. as he it wanted
did,
it.
It did. Yeah. But of course, your question was, you know, kind of what puzzle came back from testing, you know, kind of marked rejected and had to be taken out. And I can't think of anything off the top of my head. I'm sure there are plenty, but nothing's coming to mind.
Was there a time when the language failed you, where you wanted to do something and the language just wasn't up to it?
Not really. I mean, it was pretty powerful within sort of the constraints of the type of input that you wanted the player to restrict themselves to, so that those sort of, you know, present tense imperative sentences. And within that, you could pretty much say anything you wanted. And there was even power to kind of do unusual things. You know, for example, when Douglas came up with the idea of using a parser failure as the words that would fall through a wormhole and start the intergalactic war, that was certainly not something the system could do. And, you know, I told Douglas, oh, that's not something the system could do. And Douglas said to Mark, you know, can't you, you know, kind of do some kind of a hack? And Mark said, I'll see what I could do. And then the next day, I did it. and of course, that turned out to be a very wonderful and clever, you know, kind of use of the game format itself, having a parser failure, the actual player input, you know, be words that were important to the story.
So this is a chart of the different games you made in the years, and the number of rooms and the vocabulary. And I'm not sure there's a question here, except for your games got bigger and over time. And I mean, being able to do Planetfall with, you know, 669 words that it understood, that seems real small. I mean,
that's probably more than
600 words.
I mean, the verbs themselves were probably, you know, 100, 150 maybe. And so it's really, you know, the objects then that you needed to refer to, and kind of how many synonyms did you want to have. And for example, you know, you might have a rock in the game. You know, are you going to let the player refer to it as a stone? And if there were no limits, of course, you would have every possible way that a player might refer to something. But because of the limits, then you had to make compromises. And is it more important, you know, to let the player refer to things by synonyms like that? And then also, as in the case of the stalagmites, do I want to sort of limit the descriptiveness of my of the game's output, so it never refers to it as a stone, it only refers to it as a rock, etc.
When you died, typically it would call a function called jigs up. Just want to point out that the average across all Infocom games was 30 ways to die. Your games were very, very hard.
Well, basically, the rule of thumb was when you couldn't figure out any other way to handle the situation, just kill the player, and then you don't have to figure out how to kind of get out of that situation. Certainly, as you can see, A Mind Forever Voyaging, which was sort of the least puzzly of the games I wrote, has the fewest of them. And Sorcerer is actually quite impressive at 70. I would not have guessed that that was the most.
I won Mind Forever Voyaging when I was a kid in an Infocom contest, and didn't realize at the time that it was more story than puzzle, and I just thought it was brilliant that I finished it in, like, you know, 3 days. Like, I'm so smart, you know. But this is basically, there's only one puzzle at the end of the game, so thank you for that, I guess.
And even that was really just put in, wouldn't quite say as an afterthought, but kind of toward the end of development, because the powers that be were a little worried that the game wouldn't provide kind of enough hours of playtime to justify its purchase price.
So let's talk about Mind Forever Voyaging. I believe that was a game where you had a vision. I mean, all these were your vision, but something that you wanted to go in a new direction and try something to just tell about what you're trying to do.
Well, so certainly one thing about text adventure games, particularly the really hard kind of puzzly ones, was you would get stuck and they would sort of be on your mind, you know, as you kind of went through your day away from your computer, and your mind would be kind of churning away on the puzzle or puzzles you were stuck on. And then often there was a sort of a moment when you'd be like, oh my God, I never tried that, and I bet that's it. You know, and you like couldn't wait to get home and try that. And so I thought, you know, that there was something about this game format that really kind of took over your brain and kind of took over your mind share. And at the same time, A Mind Forever Voyaging came out in 85, so I would have started working on it in 84, which is when Reagan had just gotten reelected in a landslide, which horrified me that, you know, someone who at the time seemed like a bad president, and obviously in retrospect, perhaps he doesn't seem quite so bad, but in 1984, you know, I was quite horrified by not only his re-election, but his sort of easy re-election. And I thought, okay, you know, can I take the power of this interactive fiction format and, you know, couple that with essentially a political message that I wanted to, you know, to embed in people's minds like a meme. So that was sort of the genesis of the game. And when I started working on it, it was even further kind of afield from other Infocom games. It really wasn't a game at all. It was really, I would call it a future simulator. All you would do is essentially set parameters. And they were mostly sort of public policy, you know, budgetary parameters. How much are we going to spend on the space program? How much are we going to spend on the Department of Defense? And then you would go some number of years into the future and just see a simulation of the world as it would be having made those decisions at the beginning of the game. That was the entire premise of the game.
SimCity without the pesky graphics.
Sure. But, you know, but with this idea of kind of being able to jump forward 20, 30, 40, 50 years in time. Anyway, I started trying to implement that, and I realized that it was just too gargantuan a concept. There was just no way I could kind of handle, you know, every scenario that would have to be handled under that design. So then I started scaling it back, and at the same time added the storyline of, you know, the eventual Mind Forever Voyaging.
Were there hints or passed along lore that that were passed to you from other programmers when you other imps when you got there? You wrote a book at the end, near the end of your time there. I'm trying to get this to it. Called Learning Zill, or Everything You Always Wanted to Know About Writing Interactive Fiction, but couldn't find anyone still working here to ask. So you wrote that in 89, but how did you learn the coding when you got there? Was there a book, or was it just like, sit down and here's how you do it?
It was mostly either looking at it and kind of figuring it out on my own, or just asking questions of Mark Blank or Dave Loveling. Like I said, Zill was pretty easy to understand, as we saw in the code here. It's kind of readable. You know, even after 30 years of kind of not having looked at a line of Zill code, I can still look at it and pretty much figure out exactly what's going on.
How aware are you of the current crop of people making interactive fiction, either in Zill or in Form or Twine? Do you follow the current
Unfortunately not. I barely have enough time to kind of follow all the games that are in the genres I'm working on today. And so much as I would sort of love to spend more time following the IF market today, I really don't have the time to.
I've heard maybe you were thinking about making another game? Is that pure conjecture? Or?
I mean, I would love to. There's obviously very little money in it these days, so perhaps in my retirement years.
So before becoming a famous programmer, before you worked at Infocom, according to that documentary that we were watching in the pre-show, you hated computers and computer people. Why?
Well, I mean, at MIT, there were many computer people, and basically they were the sort of people who, you know, never talked about anything but. And that was, you know, really my complaint was I was not particularly interested in computers and certainly didn't want them to 100% monopolize every conversation.
Mm-hmm. So it wasn't the machines themselves, it was more the people who couldn't think about anything else.
It was the computer nerds, not the computers themselves.
Yeah. Huh. If we have any questions that have been sent in, then maybe we can get those soon. All right, so as you know, when you play one of these games, you could, to acquire a thing, you can type get lamp, or you could type take lamp. They're functionally equivalent. I need to know if you are a get person or a take person.
I'm definitely a take person.
Yeah.
Which seems horribly inefficient, doesn't it, that extra character?
Yeah, it does.
Yeah.
I was asked this a couple of years ago when we started the podcast, and I stuck by get. So I was a get person. I stuck by get and caught some flack from it from people. And then I actually took a transcript of a completed game and counted the number of times I typed get, and it was very few. And it was always get out of bed and things like that. I'm actually a take person as well. So, so what, if you could send a message to the people who are still playing these games today, what do you want to tell them?
Oh, please don't hit me.
People still angry about that babelfish, aren't they?
Well, in general, you know, a lot of puzzles in these games are hard, and when you solve them, the reaction really falls into one of two camps. Mm-hmm. That was really clever. I should have gotten that on my own. Mm. Or, wow, that was really unfair. I will hate you for the entire rest of my life.
And did you get hate mail for what happened to Floyd? I don't mean to be too spoilery, but, you know.
Yeah, not much. No.
I wanted to ask you about, if I can find it again. Oh, back to your list of every time you compiled. I want to talk about version control then versus now. how did you keep this together when you were compiling it, whatever, 50 times?
Yeah, there was definitely some... I mean, there wasn't anything formal that is anything like what we would call version control now. Mm-hmm. But every... probably at least once a day, if not more often, all the files on the Deck 20 would get saved to backup tape. And, you know, if you needed something, you could get it off that backup tape. So that was pretty much what passed for version control. Hmm. You could just say, okay, I have screwed up, you know, my copy of syntax.zil, which is the file that contained all the sentence syntaxes. And I need to go back to yesterday's or, you know, some non-corrupted version of it and get it back that way. I don't recall that happening particularly often. I mean, in general, you would make changes to the ZIL files, to the, you know, individual files that had the code in them, and then compile them. If it compiled, then that was the new version. And if you wrote something that turned out to be something you didn't want, you just pull it out again.
As you said before, a lot of the playtime of an Infocom game is thinking about the game when you're not playing the game. When you're at work, walking the dog or whatever, and you have a your brain gives you an idea. When you were making the games themselves, how much of the process was like that as well, working when you weren't working?
Very much like that, and still to this day. I mean, pretty much all game design work, I would say, falls into that category, where if I'm working on a game, I'm constantly thinking about it, and in fact, probably when I'm doing those kind of mindless things, driving, mowing the lawn, showering, that's often when the best ideas come.
And you design games today, you were telling me before we started?
So to speak. Yes.
Can you elaborate?
Well, for the last about 10 years, I've been entirely in free-to-play gaming, first social games, Facebook games, and more recently mobile games.
Nice. Any questions sent in from... we have a question here. Yes. Question should be in the form of a question, and questions have one part.
I know the Computer History Museum tries to preserve software and computers. Do you have any expectations for how they should preserve these games? And also, I know that it has pretty small game space, but did anyone solve an issue, puzzle or problem differently than how you envisioned?
The question was, did people solve puzzles in ways differently than you envisioned?
So in the first part, I mean, one of the fortunate things about Infocom games is the fact that they are so machine independent. They're all text. They'll run on almost anything. All you have to do is write an interpreter. And so they're, you know, much more widely playable today than all sorts of other games, not only of that era, but of even more recent eras than that. As far as kind of alternate solutions to puzzles, I mean, certainly people would suggest them. You know, they would say, I remember a case in Planetfall where there were dark rooms, which I put in just as a red herring, just as a, you know, kind of misdirection for the player. But there was no light source in the game, like the torch or the... or the lamp in Zork. And so I remember Dave Lebling, when he was playing Planetfall, there was some source of oil, I forget what it was, and there was a towel that I put in Planetfall as sort of an homage to Hitchhikers. And he poured the oil on the towel and then took that into the dark room and tried to set it on fire as a way of creating a light source. And I thought, well, that's a, you know, completely reasonable action. On the other hand, I didn't want to allow a light source because then all of these dark rooms that had no descriptions or routines to handle things you could do there would suddenly have to be handled. I don't remember what I did. I probably took the oil out of the game or something like that.
Or just killed a player for trying to... I was recently playing Zork 3, I think, and there's a part where you have to do a thing, and you're supposed to go through this whole area, and I managed to solve the puzzle without going through the area just by super optimizing moves. It was a certain number of moves in the dark before the Gru got you, I think, and there was Gru spray. And I got in, I did like four moves, get out, and I played it again and again until I could do it in just the right number of moves. And there was a whole area of the game that I never saw, and I didn't know that I had cheated until I talked to Carrington about it. And I was like, oh no, I never saw the dam or whatever it was. So I think that stuff snuck in sometimes.
Sure. I mean, we had increasingly more and more testing that went along with all of our games, but that didn't stop some bugs, including some pretty horrible bugs, from getting out there.
Yeah, I like the one in some early version of Deadline where you could take someone's pulse and then you could drop it again. That's good. Any more questions from out here? Yeah.
So recently, a large archive of, well, basically all the closed source Zill games that were worked on 35 years ago were released. What does it feel like emotionally as an engineer seeing what had been previously closed proprietary source, complete with comments, some of which are colorful, being visible today, and what do you want people to take away from it?
I want people to take away that I'm not an engineer. I'm a designer writer who, you know, did a little bit of coding many years ago as a necessity. But beyond that, I am kind of glad. I like the fact that sort of there's renewed interest in the games because of the code being released. And there's really nothing in, well, I guess I might be a little embarrassed as professional programmers look at my code and say, oh my God, you know, who let him anywhere near a compiler? But other than that, there's really nothing in there that I have any problem with anyone in the world seeing.
Any more from the peanut gallery? Not right now? Okay. So when people, what's the question people ask you? Like if someone comes up to you on the street or send you an email or something, are you Steve Moretzky? What's the thing that they want to know?
I guess a pretty common one is, what was Douglas like to work with on Hitchhikers? Mm-hmm. I guess another one is just people asking for specific hints. and I'm usually completely helpless there. I don't remember.
Sure.
After all this time. I don't know.
I read that for some games, the sale of hint books outpaced the sale of the software itself.
Well, that would be due to piracy. But you mentioned earlier the elaborate packaging that we did, and that was partly because we thought it was really cool, and partly it was an attempt to fight piracy by not only making people want to own the package, but also making elements of the package necessary in order to play the game.
Sure. In Leather Goddesses of Phobos, there was the scratch and sniff pad, and at times during the game it would say, you know, scratch and sniff number two, and then maybe it would set you up to make you think you're about to sniff something terrible, and it was something super gentle like soap or something like that. Tell me about the process of choosing the smells. How did that work?
That was a lot of fun. The very first smell in the game is probably the one that was most like what you're describing. It actually, the game starts in Joe's Bar in Upper Sandusky, Ohio, and as the game opens, you need to use the restroom. And there's a men's room and a women's room, and this is basically how I determined the gender of the player, depending on which restroom they used. So you would go into the restroom, and it would say, there's something unidentifiable in the corner, scratch spot number one. And it turned out to be a piece of pizza with a footnote saying, you know, you should be very thankful there were a lot more worse smells at my disposal. But the way Scratch and Sniff works is essentially it's a run through a printing press with an invisible color where the ink is just filled with all these tiny little plastic bubbles, and each one of those plastic bubbles is filled with the scent. So when you scratch it, you're just breaking a number of those bubbles. And so, you know, it has sort of a limited number of times you can scratch it before it stops releasing the odor. And the I'm not sure if they're the only manufacturer, but the manufacturer we used is 3M. And they, you could get them to create custom scents for you, but they also had something like 500 scents that they kind of had, you know, off the shelf. So I got a list of those off-the-shelf scents and picked 30 or so that I thought would be really good for the game. And they sent little samples. There were maybe 4 by 5 inch little cards with the scent printed on them and with the name of the scent at the bottom. And then I would just get people to come into my office one by one, and I would blindfold them because the name of the scent was printed on the card. And then I'd have them scratch each of the 30 and tell me what they thought it was. And that way I was able to tell what were the most recognizable scents. And I mostly used all the most recognizable scents. The one that didn't kind of perform that well in my tests was leather, but I felt I needed to have leather as one of the scents, and leather goddess is a Phobos, so I used that one. Another interesting thing that came out of that was that non-smokers were able to identify scents at a way higher rate than smokers.
And then there was the, I want to ask you about, I believe the company was called GP Copy, the company that did a lot of the marketing and actually made some of
the packaging?
The packaging.
Company? Yeah. GR.
GR Copy.
GR Dini Russell.
Did you work with them, or did they kind of work on a different level?
We usually had a kind of a kickoff meeting with them, where we would play the game with them a little and kind of talk through ideas, and they would go off and put together some proposals, and then come back and show us their ideas.
It seems like a lot in the packaging of what made Infocom Infocom was them, was their design, their interesting ideas.
Certainly Deadline was the one that really kicked it off. So before then, before Deadline, all the packages had just been the Zork packages, which were simple blister packs plus a manual. There was nothing fancy about them. And then with Deadline, it was sort of twofold. There was the fact that, as I mentioned, we were very limited in what we could put onto a floppy disk. So Mark had kind of a lot more material that he wanted the player to be exposed to in terms of solving this mystery. And by moving it from the game into the package, basically there was able to be a lot more depth to the experience. Plus, there was a series of books by an author called Dennis Wheatley that were kind of these detective portfolios. The book would have all sorts of stuff in it, like typewritten letters and handwritten letters and postage stamps. And you would basically have to read interviews and sift through clues and things like that. And then there was a sealed section where once you thought you had kind of figured out what the solution to the case was, you'd break the seal and then read the solution to the case. So both Mark and the folks at GR were very much inspired by those books, and creating the Deadline package was an attempt to create that same kind of multimedia, multi-sensory experience.
Do you recall any feelies that somebody wanted to add to an Infocom game that it wasn't practical to get in there ultimately?
I'm sure there were. There are none coming to mind. We tended to have a budget of maybe 75 cents a package, and that had to cover not only the feelies, but the manual and things like that as well. So I can remember some that were particularly challenging. Certainly the scratch and sniff card was, and I was hoping to have more than the 7 cents that we were eventually able to afford. Certainly a very famous one was the glow-in-the-dark stone from
which
the Wishbringer
glowed,
package.
Which glowed purple instead of the usual green.
Yes.
Which is amazing.
And I remember in another one of Brian's games, Beyond Zork, there was a multi-page glossy brochure, which I'm not sure what it was about it, but that was a real budget buster. I think that cost like over $1, and that sort of set package feely budgets back after that.
I haven't played that one yet, so no spoilers.
And another interesting story about package feelies is that we haven't really talked about this, but Infocom was divided into two halves, a game side of the company and a business product side of the company. And Hitchhikers came out with the Don't Panic button. And then later, the first and only business product to come out of the business product side of the company, a database called Cornerstone, came out. And one of the things that they put in the box was a Don't Panic button. different color, but otherwise, you know, just like the one in the Hitchhiker's box. And as a sign of, you know, kind of the relative cost controls of the two sides of the company, I think, you know, the button, the don't panic button in the Hitchhiker's box costs 7 cents, and the one in the Cornerstone box costs something like 75 cents.
Is it true, in your opinion, that Cornerstone is what killed Infocom?
I think it killed Infocom sooner than it would have, but the entire interest in sort of alt-text games was waning, and Infocom, of course, tried to get into graphic games toward the end, and it was sort of a little bit too little too late. Would things have gone differently if we hadn't been part of Activision? Would they have gone differently if, you know, kind of Infocom wasn't in a big financial hole after losing millions of dollars on Cornerstone? You know, it's hard to say. But certainly things were trending in the wrong direction, regardless of Cornerstone.
But Infocom ultimately saved Activision when they had the IP and they were going bankrupt, and they managed to resell Infocom software.
It's true. They went through bankruptcy in 91, and pretty much what kept them afloat was issuing the Lost Treasures of Infocom. And then I forget what the second one was called, Lost Treasures
Lost
of
Treasures
Infocom 2.
Yeah.
And
super creative guys there.
And between them they had all the Infocom games in them except I think Shogun, which I think the rights had already lapsed.
Right.
And maybe one of the later graphic games that was probably too big to fit even on the 15 or so floppies that went into that box. And, you know, they sold for a really high price point, maybe $150 or something like that. And my recollection is they sold 70,000 copies or something like that during a time when, you know, the company was essentially insolvent. So that's what kept Activision around to become the big company that it is today.
All right, so a question about archiving games. I mean, somebody had this stuff, it's put it up on GitHub, and now it's there. And it's there because it was on physical media, it was on the CD-ROMs, it was on the floppy disks. The games that are being created now, including stuff that you've worked on for iPhones and free-to-play games and everything, they don't exist in physical media, and the servers can go away, and the Apple Store could, you know, delete them, and then they're gone. What do you think that means for game preservation, or even just people in 30 years who want to reminisce about the games they're playing now? How is the way games are being stored and saved and used now going to change how we're using them down the line?
I think what it means for game preservation is it just needs to be an ongoing effort. Yeah, I mean, you need to kind of look at live games and sort of preserve them on a periodic basis, knowing that eventually at some point, whether it's a month or a year or a decade from now, they are going to go away, and if you haven't preserved them before then they're lost. And, you know, it's certainly not just live games, you know, that live in the cloud somewhere, but there's also just the problem with, you know, I have all sorts of games that I've worked on that are no longer playable. You know, they're playable only on, say, XP or earlier versions of Windows or that sort of a thing. Or, you know, they're playable on an early version of a console, but, you know, they're not upwardly compatible. And there are obviously emulators and things like that can be used to attempt to make games playable, but often, you know, I will use some sort of a DOS emulator or early version of Windows emulator and still not be able to get a game to run.
Yeah. So whose job is it to preserve them?
I think that's your job.
It's my job?
Yes.
Excellent. I mean, I would like to think it's the job of the companies who are creating the software, but I feel like for many companies, they're just busy getting out the product and moving on to the next thing, and they're not thinking about saving their own history.
I think that's a pipe dream. You know, I think it's going to have to be museums, universities, people like that.
What do you think the odds are that Activision is going to send a DMCA and take down the very thing that we're here talking about today?
You know, their attitude toward the Infocom stuff has been very odd over the years. They certainly have released free, you know, online playable versions of a lot of the games when it suited their interests. I believe they did with Leather Goddesses when Leather Goddesses 2 came out. I believe they did with the Zork trilogy when various later Zork games came out. I'm not really sure what's going on currently with the mobile playable versions of the Infocom games. I know they were selling some equivalent of the Lost Treasures on iOS for a while, and someone just told me since the source code went up on GitHub that they went to look for that, and it wasn't, not only was it not in the App Store, but the version that they had downloaded either had disappeared from their phone or wasn't playable anymore.
About a year and a half ago, something happened with the iOS version that the software stopped working, and there was a petition. People asked Activision to update it, and it was crickets was the response.
Anyway, so this is, you know, sort of typical of their, you know, random kind of attention to the IP.
Yeah. So if someone sees the code and is inspired to do their own Zil programming, they mean they've got your 78-page book, which is downloadable. That's a pretty, you know, I bought a book on, you know, how to program Python, and the thing is like 700 pages. So 80 pages to learn Zil seems doable. But do you have any inspiration or hints or something for someone who's interested today in learning Zil?
No, I think looking at the existing code and looking at that manual should tell you everything you need to know.
All right. A couple minutes left. We have a question?
Yeah, I've got a question from the stream. How does it feel to know that there's a renewed love for coding games using Zil in the original Infocom way?
It's a little weird. It's kind of hard to imagine that in 30-plus years that's still the best way to get an alt-text game to appear on a computer.
I don't know if it's the best way anymore, but it's certainly a way. Inform and Twine are the popular ways to do it now, but mm-hmm. Some people, they'll play the old-school games, might as well write it in the old-school way.
Were there any games that you had in mind but never had a chance to actually create? If yes, what were they?
Well, the very last game I was working on when Infocom got shut down was a game set on the Titanic. Always was sort of a big fan of the Titanic story since I read Walter Lord's A Night to Remember when I was a kid. And I always thought that would be a terrific setting for a game. And, you know, never, of course, got a chance to get very far out of the starting gate with that implementation at Infocom before the studio was shut down. And then for a number of years afterward, I tried to get different publishers interested in doing a Titanic game. And there are any number of times when I was told, oh, no one's interested in the Titanic. And actually, when I had my own studio in the mid-90s, Bafo Games, we were again pitching a Titanic game, and we actually got a prototype funded by Broderbund. And then, basically after we finished the prototype and we were waiting for them to decide whether to, you know, green-light it for full production, it was announced that another studio was working on a Titanic game, which ended up coming out under the name Titanic: An Adventure Out of Time. And so Broderbund said, oh, you know, well, we don't want to compete against another Titanic game, so we're not greenlighting the project. And then that other Titanic game came out almost the same time as the Cameron movie, and I think was the number two game of the year after Myst. So, anyway, I don't even know how I got on this Titanic thread.
You were asked if any projects that you wanted to do but didn't do.
Yes. Another project that I always wanted to do at Infocom that just never came together was something that was a little gimmicky, but I thought would be really fun, which was to basically start with a little kernel of maybe a couple of rooms and one character and five objects or something like that, and then just have all the implementers, or at least, you know, at least four or so implementers, write a kind of, you know, one quarter size game starting with that kernel, and then see how everyone would kind of go off in different narrative and puzzle directions from that same starting point.
Like starting with a writing prompt and seeing where the writers went.
Well, I mean, in a Zill code sense, just giving everyone a kernel is sort of what we would refer to when you started writing a game. You would just take some previous game, usually whatever game was kind of closest to the one that you were going to start writing, and strip away everything, you know, that was, you know, not specific to the game, or that was specific to the game, leaving just the generic code. And we always refer to that as a kernel, you know. So I was saying, let's take a kernel, and let's take a blank kernel, and then just write a couple of rooms, character, three objects, whatever. Just, you know, 2% of the code of a game, and then let everyone take that as a starting point. And so, as the player experience would be, you would play basically four different games that would be kind of identical for the first couple of minutes, and then go off in very different directions.
Super interesting. Do any others come to mind?
No, I can't think of anything else.
Okay. Fair enough.
If you could rewrite any solutions, would you? Which one would it be?
I mean, I don't think there's... To some extent, we kind of had that opportunity, even though they weren't live games. We were constantly putting out new versions of games. And that was, you know, as a current supply of already printed discs would get used up, and it was time to make more. Or as a new PC came out, and then someone would write an interpreter for it, and all of the Infocom games would then be running on it. So over the course of years, you would have plenty of opportunity to update games, fix bugs that hadn't been caught during the initial testing period, but were reported by players in the real world, etc. On the other hand, there were the hint booklets, and so certainly you couldn't change anything that would obviate the, you know, clues that were in hint booklets. So there were, you know, certainly updates that we made over time, maybe to give an extra hint or two if a puzzle seemed too hard or too unfair, but no, you know, no major rewriting. And in general, I can't really see why we would have. We did, to this extent, continue to pay attention to the older games, but for the most part, all the focus was on what's next.
That's all the questions. How involved were you in writing the hint books? Did that go to someone else, or was that?
Oh, for my games, I always wrote them all. That kind of varied from implementer to implementer. Mm-hmm. Some like me wanted to write their own, and others were fine to leave that to, you know, QA or marketing.
I think we're about out of time. Any final thoughts?
No. Right. I didn't really even have any initial thoughts.
Thank you, Steve Bransky.
Thank you. Thank you, Steve and Kevin, for coming in and streaming with us today.
So that's it. That was my day. And then I flew back the same night. I felt like some sort of like jet setting. I did an interview and I was just like, out, I'm out. Sorry,
you know, get out, take your swag and go.
Yeah, take my swag. Have my drink.
It's a new form of push request.
Push them out the door. And go.
I like the bit where people are saying, as a software engineer, what does it feel like having formerly closed source code, including comments, like sometimes colorful comments, mm-hmm. being released to the public? And he's like, well, first of all, I'm not an engineer. It's like he's a writer designer. And like the way somebody can view themselves a certain way, because he's like one of the biggest names historically in computer, you know, gaming, like as a computer game creator, he's one of the big ones. I think he was on that list of 25 game gods or whatever. Mm-hmm. So it's interesting that his knee-jerk reaction is, I'm not a software engineer. Like, essentially, I'm not a developer. I'm a writer and designer, which is, you know, carried through to what he's been doing now. But I thought that was an interesting distinction. But it's always one of those big questions. Like, this came about because of, you know, proprietary source code mm-hmm. being saved and now released to the public, like closed source stuff, just saying, here it is, everyone look at it.
Right.
Which is, I think, in some circles, a contentious thing. And I think that's the case with the whole Infocom drive. Like, I don't even really understand all either the politics, the mechanics behind it or whatever, but right. like the stuff that was closed and maybe sometimes personal then just gets preserved. I think preserving is important, but then also gets released publicly while people are still alive and such. And so it can be mm-hmm. a contentious issue. But yeah. It was interesting to hear that from his standpoint, he's like, well, great, it's nothing that I wouldn't want, and I'm happy it's preserved.
Sure.
And great that it's out there. So yeah. It's nice to hear that from somebody who's involved in these things saying, no, it was totally good.
Yeah, right. And that was certainly his opinion and not the opinion of Activision, which still owns the copyright to this stuff and might not even know that it's up yet and might have a different opinion than the rest mm-hmm. of us.
Sometimes that is the difference, because when we look at dealing with copyright, dealing with any of these things, you often have a creator mm-hmm. and then you have essentially like a middleman. You have like a publisher, and the people who own the rights and make the money off it can sometimes have a difference of opinion with the people who say, like, they made the art, they're no longer going to profit from it. It's like, hey, I want my art out there. And so you can have two very opposing forces, which, you know, are coming to play here in a sense, I guess. I don't think there's any lawsuits about this or whatever, but are you going, here's my question for you,
yeah.
jet-setting interviewer Kevin Savitz, mm-hmm. of Kevin Savitz fame, mm-hmm. have you any intention of going through the source code and reading Steve's book on how to implement these things and creating something old school style?
I will if you will.
I really want to. Would I ever have time to? But holy cow.
Maybe.
It seriously appeals to me.
People keep asking, like, what are we going to do when we finish all the games? Maybe we could consider, and I'm not making promises to anybody.
Maybe you're okay.
I'm just throwing out a random idea that passing through my brain. Maybe we could consider you and I trying to make tiny little games just to, you know, two-room games for each other just to see if we can.
So I love the idea. The only caveat would be, we have established you have less of a problem than me in being super critical about a game, and I feel guilty. So when we review our own games, it'll be like, let's all pile on character.
But you are a far superior programmer than I am.
See, you can't. That's unfair, because then when mine sucks, it's like, well, look at you, Mr. Programmer guy with suck age. But I it's always appealed to me. Like, text adventures have appealed to me, but also creating text adventures has always appealed to me. And the idea of, like, doing one the way, you know, the Infocom people did it, like, that is, like, it's, I hold it to such a high standard. And it doesn't matter if maybe there's easier ways to do it now, or Inform 7 would be, what, like, sometimes you just want to do something old school. Like, it just, when I make something for the Apple II, it's fun to do it sometimes because it's harder. So yeah. There's a lot of appeal to it. So regardless, I'm glad this stuff has been released. Like, I for one, am delighted the source code is available. And I'm very interested in reading through Steve's book to see if, you know, any of this could rub off on me.
We'll it's just a little 88 pages, you know, how to do, or 78 pages of how to program it. Yeah. And you were saying before, I just want to get back to having information released that maybe they never thought would be released. And mm-hmm. during the talk, I made him go through just two little pages of source code to explain what was happening. And it's pretty obvious, easy stuff. But, like, just in those two pages, there is a call to an action or a function or whatever it's called in this language called fucking clear. And and it's just like, I can just imagine someone goes like, we have to reset this bit, it's not working, you know, and I'm calling it that. And yeah, you know, of course, no one would ever do that if they thought it would be released, but
exactly. And then you get the publishers will say, well, we can't release that because will we be sued as Activision because we've now put up this thing that didn't have a warning on or whatever. Like people, America in particular can be pretty lawsuit heavy. So some people think, well, will there be liability if we put out a thing that had a bad word and should we have, and who knows what, right? So people just understandably maybe get a little worried about it.
Yeah.
But I am full on positive about this stuff being preserved and being out there and very excited to read it myself.
Absolutely. Mm. Yeah. Cool.
So I should say, I guess it's, you know, if you've already listened to the interview, then you'd already know this. But I think you did a really good job of hosting an interview about Infocom with a person who created Infocom stuff and asking really good detailed questions. And yet it being a spoiler free kind of thing that like I went into this nervous, like, am I going to learn stuff about games that I don't want to know that I haven't played yet? Mm-hmm. And I came out of it just happy that I listened to the interview. So I thought, well done you, because it'd be easy to make this something that would spoil games for people who hadn't played them yet. And I thought you skirted that very nicely.
Thank you. I tried.
Yeah. Well done. Well done. Total. Like that was great. I'm very glad to have listened to it.
Thank you. Yeah, it was fun to do. It was just like one of those opportunities that, sure, yeah, I'll do that, you know. And when Jason calls me up and goes, so what are you doing Friday? Like, nothing. Like, okay.
Nothing.
All right, so last thing, how are you doing on Spellbreaker?
I thought this was our Spellbreaker episode. So that's Spellbreaker. Actually, I'm super close. There's a chance I may finish maybe today. If not, I think that I feel like I'm right there. I think I know what to do. Mm-hmm. I think I'm going to finish soon.
Okay.
It has been by far the hardest one we've played.
Yeah.
By far. And I've cheated a bunch of times and still, my goodness.
I have stalled on it because I got distracted by the 10-line basic programming contest. And then when I was just about ready to get back into it, then I had to spend a week preparing for interviewing Moretzky. I'm ready to dive back into Spell. I don't think I'm close to the end yet. Maybe you can tell me. I'm a part where that involves a compass and walls.
Okay.
Well,
the thing is, you can do a lot of this in different orders too, though.
That's what I'm currently thinking about. So
right.
So
it doesn't get easier.
Oh,
just so you know.
Okay.
You're not like over the hump and there's only an easy bit left. No, it's all hard. It's all hard. It's hard all the way down.
All right. So for sure, next episode will be Spellbreaker.
Yeah, maybe.
Maybe.
Good chance. I'd say
to be released in 2020.
One in four chance. Exactly. But who knows what else will come up. Maybe something else will come. We'll have another little short episode like this. But the next full reviewed game will be Spellbreaker, is at least our intention. So we will see what episode.
Yes.
But in the meantime, I guess we can wrap up and say that this has been Eaten by a Gru, a special edition of the Infocom podcast. Mm-hmm. If you want to send us feedback about this, or you can get in touch with Kevin directly about the interview, but you can reach us both at gru@monsterfeet.com or on Twitter. He is @KevinSavitz. I am @Carrington. And Kevin may fly around the globe, knock on your door and interview you if you give us a nice review on iTunes.
Could
which
happen.
Rumor has it helps other people find our podcast, but I'm still dubious about that. Show notes and such can be found at monsterfeet.com, and thanks to MC Frontalot for flying around the globe right behind Kevin and playing theme songs as he interviews people, because that's how he rolls, and he let us use his song as our theme tune, and we appreciate it. And we will see you next time for Spellbreaker. Really.
Oh no. You have walked into the slavering fangs of a lurking Gru.
All people who type get are wrong.
Okay.
Take people all the way. Well, don't take people all the way. But, you know, up with take people. Yeah.